We're back into our study this evening for the Samson Syndrome. This is part four. Don't forget, before we go any further, this Sunday, February 9th, after service is what?
Chili cook-off.
Excellent. So come prepared with some food to eat some food. So we still have a few items out there. If you haven't signed up to do something or bring something, please do so we can enjoy some of your favorite stuff. Yeah. Why? Do you want to stay home and watch the Super Bowl? Oh. Oh, well, maybe that's it. Well, here's the idea. We offer it anyway. Unless something comes up or unless it's a scheduled time when we don't have services, we will have life groups. And if people have big Super Bowl bashes, they're more than welcome to stay home and watch Super Bowl. We'll continue on. So, honestly, I don't want to see the Eagles or the Chiefs. So, now, if it was one of my favorite teams in there, we wouldn't be having life group on Sunday night. I'm just telling you. All right, let's redirect. Yeah, there's dessert. Yeah, there's desserts on the sign-up sheet. Sign up, bring a dessert. Not just to eat it, but bring one. All right, so we're talking about the Samson Syndrome. We're talking about strong people, not just men, but strong men tend to disregard boundaries. We talked about that. First off, strong men tend to ignore good advice. And last week, we talked about strong men tend to break the rules. Tonight, I want to talk to you about strong men tend to overestimate their cleverness. Overestimate their cleverness. There was a story given in the book, talked about a gentleman who lived across the street from the bowling alley, and he saw the armored truck pull up every week on Thursday at 6 p.m., and he would come out with these two big, huge bags of cash, and he thought, man, that would be great just to have that cash. So he made his plan. He would hide out in the bushes and wait till every week that armored car would come at the exact same time and pick up and he knew the time. He knew it was just one guy. He knew all the stuff and the things. And so he said, next Thursday, it's going to be the day. So he got out, hid in the bushes, waited until the armored truck pulled up. Guy went inside. Exactly 4 minutes and 37 seconds until he come back out. And when he did, he pulled his shotgun on him, and the guy dropped the bags, and the guy grabbed, both bags were too heavy to carry, so he just grabbed one of them and took off into the woods, and he thought he would be able to get around, escape, and then drive his car around the block for a couple times before he could pull into his driveway across the street from the bowling alley. And he did that, and the armored car driver went into the bowling alley and said, man, a guy just robbed me. And he goes, robbed me? Did he take your wallet? And he goes, no, he took the bag of dirty towels that I was going to clean. And so what happened was is he thought that he had an armored car, and it wasn't. And so sometimes people overestimate their cleverness when it comes to doing things. Now, Samson was an intelligent person. He was a very intelligent person, but there were times when he overestimated his own cleverness. Judges chapter 14. Open to Judges 14. Remember that he demanded a wife from his parents, and so they went down to get the wife that he wanted, and he was pleasing in his eyes, and so they come back, and they went down for all of the stuff to do, and what happens is he goes down to marry this woman in Judges chapter 14. We're looking at verse 10 through 11. Remember verses 1 through 9. He goes down with his mom and dad, kills the lion, remember, and then he goes back a couple weeks later and then gets some honey and gives it to his parents and all that stuff. Well, this is some time after he goes down to actually marry his bride. And in Judges 14, verse 10 and 11, it says, his father went down to the woman, and Samson prepared a feast there. For so the young men used to do. This is like a wedding feast, like a bachelor party, whatever. Actually, in Bible times, it was nothing but a drunken fest. But as soon as the people saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. So this bachelor party's got 30 of the Philistine men with Samson, and it's a 7-day feast or a 7-day drinking binge. Wasn't very appropriate for somebody who was under the Nazarite vow, right? Because they would drink wine back in those days, and part of the Nazarite vow was not to touch wine. And so he had already touched something dead, so he had broke that. So Samson decides that he's going to have a little fun with these 30 groomsmen. Okay, all these Philistine guys are going to come. I'm going to have a little fun. So as I said, he was kind of a very intelligent person. So in verse 12 through 13, it says this. And Samson said to them, let me now put a riddle to you. Riddle me this. If you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen garments, 30 changes of clothes. But if you cannot tell me what it is, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. And they said to him, put your riddle so that we can hear it. So the 30 changes of garment is nothing more than what it was. Is they had their undershirts. It was like a long gown. And then they had the robes that they put over it. So it was an undergarment and then the outer garment. Like today for us, it'd be like a shirt and then a suit coat. So you'd have an undershirt and it's kind of one deal, but for them, it was two. So he said 30 changes of clothes. Now for him, he had to come up with 30 changes of clothes. But for them, they had less to spend because if they lost, each person would only have to do one, right? So that was a good deal for them. And so Samson presents this to them in this way. And so if they failed, that they weren't out that much except one set of clothes. Now, what was the riddle? Verse 14, he says, and Samson said to them, out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. And in 3 days, they could not solve the riddle. So it's a 7-day feast, 7-day binge, and here they are 3 days into it, and they have no clue what the heck he's talking about. We know what he's talking about because we remember what happened, right? And so a little bit of intelligent riddle for him to come up with. Now, he has this, as I said, this is something weird because usually in a dead, rotting carcass, you're going to find maggots and flies. But you have a bunch of happy bees making honey, and that's, I don't know, that's just unusual to me for some reason. But the Philistines had no clue. 3 days in, they have absolutely no clue. But here's the thing. Samson thought that he was so clever that he was guaranteed to win. There's no way for them to know. No way for them to know. I'm going to win. But he never counted on them to cheat to get the answer. Sometimes people are so clever that they don't, well, they're not so clever because they overestimate their own cleverness. Or they don't count on other people's trickery. These Philistines, man, they were so stumped that they turned into a bunch of backstabbing, backbiters, blackmailers, all that stuff. Verse 15, it goes on. Listen to what they say. So on the fourth day, they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband to tell us what the riddle is. This is what we're going to do if you don't. We're going to burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us here to impoverish us? Now remember, they're only losing one garment. Samson would lose 30. He would have to come up with 30. They would only lose one. And they're like, oh, you want to put us into poverty? Yeah, you're losing one garment. Big deal. But they didn't want to lose. They didn't want to lose at all. So on the fourth day, they tried to blackmail Samson's wife and say, you make Samson tell us what the whole deal is. Verse 14, or chapter 14, verse 16 through 17, it says, Samson's wife wept over him and said, "You hate me. You don't love me. You put a riddle to my people, and you have not told me what it is." And he said to her, "Behold, I have not told my father nor my mother, and shall I tell you?" But she wept, and she wept before him the 7 days that the feast lasted. And on the seventh day, he told her because she pressed him very hard. And then she told the riddle to her people. That's what happens when somebody wears you out. In this case, with his wife's nagging. She nagged him into telling him the secret. She wept and wept and wept until he finally gave in. Now, this is like movie stuff. This is down to the seventh day, to the last hour, to the last minute. Here you go, the countdown's going on, and Samson thinks he's going to get everything that he's supposed to get. But Samson thought they'd play by the rules, and they didn't. What Samson lacked was discernment. What is discernment? What would you say discernment is? Discernment. Judgment. What else? Discernment. What's true, what's not true. Ability to see the picture. What else? Discernment.
Make decisions.
Make decisions. Yeah, that's judgment. That's, yeah. What else? Give me one more.
Wisdom.
Well, that's good. Yeah. John Maxwell defines discernment as this: the ability to see through to the heart of the matter, to really see what's truly going on. Discernment. Yeah, wisdom, good judgment, simply knowing when and where to draw the line. That's discernment. Know when to give up. Strong men fall prey to being clever for their own good is because they lack discernment. Good discernment. Because discernment has a lot of enemies. There are seven deadly enemies of discernment, all mentioned in Proverbs. And so we got to be careful that we're not falling into traps of these enemies. The trickery of these enemies like Samson did. Let me give you those seven deadly enemies. It's like the seven deadly sins. These are the seven deadly enemies of discernment. Number one, pride. Number one is pride. Proverbs 16:18, it says, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." That's always what happens. But could you imagine Samson's like, "Nobody's going to get this. I'm the only one that knows that this is a lion and it was honey inside of it. Nobody else knows. My mom and dad didn't even know. Nobody knows. I've got 30 pieces of clothing coming from all these guys." Very prideful. And he overestimated his opponents pretty much. One of the recent things that comes to mind, matter of fact, is World War II. The Japanese aligned with Nazi Germany, and I don't know really what they were thinking, that they were really going to get over on America, such a small country as Japan, to come over to bomb Pearl Harbor in 1941 and think that they were going to get away with it. I think they overestimated their cleverness. It wasn't until 1945, but that's when we dropped the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. That reminds me of Jaws because Robert Shaw did that in the boat. I'm sorry. I apologize. That's a good movie. But he goes through the whole USS Indianapolis thing where, and they did. The USS Indianapolis had the components for the A-bomb. And actually, they dropped them on, one was Hiroshima and the other was Nagasaki. And they killed a lot of people. But why? Now, the Japanese, they sunk the USS Indianapolis, but the submarine. But the whole idea is that did you really think that you were going to be that clever to come over and bomb America and really think you're going to get away with it? But they didn't. And so they paid the ultimate price. Pride goes before destruction. And boy, they stood up there proud beside Adolf Hitler when they shook hands with him, and they were in that, I forget what the name of the pact was, that they had a, there was a, what was it? The Warsaw Pact. It was Hitler and the Japanese emperor guy and a third one. I forget who the third one was. Was it Mussolini? You have to brush up on your history. We're doing Bible trivia tonight. But here you have, you know, a guy with a small country bombing a big country and thinks he's going to get away with it. And he didn't. And so, number two, the controlling part of alcohol. And this, I say the controlling part because you can't specifically say alcohol is the problem. It's the biblical word drunk. And the biblical word drunk means anything that has control over you. And that's that doesn't just go with alcohol. That's the problem. Because we see that in many passages. In the Old Testament, in the Psalms, it says that God's arrows were drunk with the blood of the heathen. And so God doesn't drink, so can't be alcoholic if you're talking about drunk. In Revelation, the woman that rides the dragon, she was drunk with the blood of the saints. And so it's just talking about what you allow to control you. It was her hatred for the Christians that she wants to kill in the tribulation period. And so it's what you allow to control you. That's why I say the controlling aspect of alcohol, because it can be very quickly controlling. And so Proverbs 20 verse 1 says, wine is a mocker, strong drink is a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. What was Samson doing for 7 days? Having a drinking fest. Probably not the wisest thing. Why? Because you're going to make a mistake in something. That's why God said that the kings were not to be drunk when they made their judgments. Because you are not to pervert God's judgment on his people. So you're to have your own law, you're to have your own everything, and you weren't to drink. That way you don't pervert judgment on God's people.
Mm-hmm. Well, believe me, the alcohol comes real free there. Because these people are bidding on $1 million cars.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
They sure will. And they're a lot more easier to raise the pallet when they've had a few.
It's interesting.
And so, and that's the thing, because, I don't get into the alcohol aspect, but there's a lot of things that do that. What's the spirits in painting or something, or the something in canvas or wine, and I forget what it is where you can paint and you can have some wine, sip and paint or something. I forget what it's called, but yeah, a lot of people do that stuff. But here's the idea: the ones that go into paint to like learn how to do little paintings and stuff, there's not many people that show up to those. But the ones that have wine or alcohol to them, man, they get tons of people come in. And they make a lot of money doing it. Yeah, and the alcohol's free. You got to pay for the painting and the paint and the lesson and all this stuff, but you got free alcohol. And people just come out of the woodwork to do all that stuff. That's crazy, but yeah. So it's the controlling aspect of alcohol. Don't allow it to control you. Not very smart for you to have a 7-day binge and then think you're going to be very clever with 30 guys. That's 30 people. That's 30 people can put their heads together. He thought he was very clever, that he could outsmart 30 people. That's kind of odd, isn't it? One going up against 30? That's a lot, but he was very arrogant too. Number three, anger. The third deadly enemy of discernment is anger. Proverbs 27:4 says, wrath is cruel and anger is overwhelming. It's one of the ways that we don't say, don't react out of emotion, that's for sure. July 5th, 2000, a man by the name of Thomas Junta, he thought that his son's hockey coach allowed the boys to play way too rough. And so after practice, Thomas had a few words with the coach, and they exchanged some words back and forth, and Thomas got very angry and a fight broke out. And, Thomas outweighed the coach by 150 pounds, and so he beat the tar out of the coach. Well, unfortunately, due to that fight, the coach broke something in his skull, and it fractured his brain, and He actually bled out from complications. And so Thomas was charged with involuntary manslaughter. And he got 6 to 10 years. Now, here's the deal. I only bring this one up is because he could have gotten out with good behavior between 4 and 6 years and all of that. But the parole board felt that he did not truly accept responsibility for what he had done. And so he served the full 10 years. Just one of those deals. Didn't get out until 2010. Served the full 10 years. Could have got out early. But he had no remorse for what he did. Kind of got angry, like he thought it was the other guy's fault, the coach's fault that he beat up on him or something. It's a shame. Number 4, lust. Pride, controlling aspect of alcohol, anger, and lust. Proverbs 6:32 says, "He who commits adultery lacks sense. He who does it will just destroy himself." Many years ago, and you can look this up because I had to look this up, but this was kind of funny. An airline had a promotion called Fly Your Wife for Free. And so what they were doing is it was supposed to encourage businesses that had businessmen flying all over the country. It was supposed to encourage them to bring their wives with them when they went out of town. The airline had to cancel the program because they had thousands of angry letters from the actual wives. It seemed that when they opened letters from the airlines, it said, "Thank you for traveling with your husband with our airline to this place," when they hadn't left the house. And so all these husbands in their business were taking women that weren't their wives on this Fly Your Wife for Free program, and they weren't even their wives, and they were opening up the letters like, "On what in the world? I haven't flown anywhere. Who did you fly with? How'd you like to see that letter when you got home?" Oh, not be a good one. Number 5. Greed. Very bad when you're trying to do discernment. Proverbs 1:18-19 says, "But these men lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives. Such are the ways of everyone who is greedy for unjust gain. It takes away the life of its possessors." Some people just aren't content with what they have. And some people just, when they get enough, they just want something more. They just want just that little bit more. And that greed always puts them over the edge. So many stories with that. I don't even want to get into any of them. 6, huh? Yes, I'm sorry. All I got to do is write down the reference. Six is hatred. Proverbs 26:26 says, "Though his hatred be covered with deception, his wickedness will be exposed in the assembly." A college student was dumped by his girlfriend. And so knowing that she hated snakes, he was going to get even with her. So him and some of his fraternity brothers, they found some little garden snakes. And they put, I don't know, 5 or 6 of them through the doggy door in her place. And so when her girlfriend, ex-girlfriend now, when his ex-girlfriend woke up the next day and went in to take a shower, and she opened the shower curtain, there was all of the snakes in the shower that had gathered into one spot. And it took her by surprise so bad that she jumped back, slipped on the tile, and busted her head on the vanity behind her. And it fractured her skull and killed her instantly. And so you talk about hatred, man. They took every one of the people that were involved into custody. And that's just guilty by association. You're going to help do all that stuff. I'm sure it'll be involuntary manslaughter. But, man, can you imagine that? Hating somebody that bad? Now, just like anything, it was all in good fun. You're just trying to get even because she broke up with you. You didn't intend for her to die, right? But that's what happens. We never intend for things to go that bad. You just want to get a little even. And so hatred is a very, not a very good thing. Number seven, impatience. Impatience. Proverbs 27:12 says, "The prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple just keep going on and they suffer for it." Think of speeders. And I'm sure we all speed at one time or another. Don't sit there and tell me you don't speed. Well, maybe you don't speed. I just fracture maybe a mile or two over. But 1 mile an hour over is still over. Amen? Whether it's 100 over or 1 over, it's still over. But think of how many people are in such a big hurry to get wherever the heck they're going. You see the light turn yellow, and how many people just floor it? I mean, I see people that just, you know, come up to a stop sign and or a traffic light, and they got the stop, and they're getting ready to turn, and you're coming up on them, and they just pull out in front of you anyway because they're just in a big hurry. It's like, holy mackerel, buddy, you in a big hurry? And that's what makes me in a big hurry, because then you get people that are do 25 and a 45, and you're like, oh my goodness, are you on a Sunday drive? We're going to ruin this person. But that's when you calm down, don't react out of emotion. But according to the National Highway Safety Administration, the economic cost of speeding to our society is almost $30 billion a year. $30 billion a year. Speeding is a contributing factor in 30% of all fatal crashes. 15,000 lives are lost each year due to speeding-related accidents. A prudent person slows down and looks ahead very carefully and very thoughtfully before they proceed slowly. We got to be careful. We can't get too impatient about doing things. And so oh, there you go. Well, that was nice. Could buy a car and have a little more metal around you. But don't try to get even. All right. So, here's the seven enemies of discernment. Pride, the controlling part of alcohol, anger, lust, greed, hatred, and impatience. You got to be careful of those guys. So, if you have any weakness in one or all of these seven areas, then you could make some very foolish decisions. That's why we want to have discernment and make sure that you're taking care of or putting things into practice to prevent some of these things from being part of your decision making. So, if you need some discernment, you need some help in making better decisions, let me give you four. You remember the story of Joseph in Genesis 39. You remember Joseph and his life, and after his brothers sold him into slavery, and he goes into Potiphar's house, and he does such a great job, and Potiphar puts him in charge of everything that's in his house except his wife. And then his wife tries to have relations with him, and he turns her down. That's a beautiful illustration to stop and have some discernment to make decisions. Let me give you those four principles here. Number one is look around. Look around at what you have. See that you are blessed in all of your surroundings. Now, in Genesis 39, matter of fact, go back to Genesis 39. If you have your Bibles, go back to Genesis 39. All the way back to the beginning. We'll go through a few passages here. So in Genesis 39, verse 8 and 9, Moses writes this. So Joseph is telling Potiphar's wife, "My master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you." So he looks around and he says, everything in this house I'm in charge of. This is my master's stuff, and he's put me in charge of all these things. So he's looking around. He's looking around at every blessing that he has been given. He's been put in charge of everything around him, except, as he said, except you. That's the one thing that's off limits. But look at all this stuff I'm in charge of. I'm in charge of all of these things. Why would I do something to jeopardize that? That's what you have to look at. Next time you have a decision make, look at what you have. Look at what you have around you. Look at what is in your charge. Look at what the blessings God has given you. And you doing something against what you see around you to jeopardize all that. Why would you want to lose what you have? And that's what he did. He looked around. He's like, man, I got it made here. Why do I want to jeopardize that with you? And then, of course, number two, you want to look within. Look around at your blessing. Count your blessings. Name them one by one and see all the blessings you have around you. But number two, look within. Look within. He says this in verse 9. How then can I do this great wickedness? He's like, man, this is something I can't do. I cannot do this. Look within yourself. If you don't want to lose all the stuff you got, then you need to do something to get out. You need to choose to live a higher moral standard. Live that higher moral standard, and that was God's standards. Knowing that anything that he did was actually against God, but he looked within himself to say, I can't do this. This is wicked. This is wicked, and I'm living by a higher moral standard. Number three, look to the future. Look to the future. In Genesis 39:9, he says this, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you're his wife. Okay, why would Joseph want to lie with Potiphar's wife? Did he have a future there? What? If she divorces Potiphar, she don't get nothing. She's not going to have anything. He's the ruler. He's the one that's in charge. He's the one that's got the money. He's the one that give him the house and her the house. And everything that she has was because of Potiphar. And so to look to the future, what you're about to do, what's going to be the future in that? What future are you going to have in that decision? And so when you think about those things, look at that. Joseph had no future with another man's wife, especially his master's. And he knew he'd wind up in prison. And so he chose not to do anything with her. So, would you get on a plane if it had a 90% chance of crashing? I don't think that I would either. Would you get on a plane with 75% chance of crashing? 50% chance? That's half and half. 25% chance? Where's it going? Going to the Bahamas. What if it had a 10% chance of crashing?
Yes.
10% you'd go?
Or lower.
10% or lower? Okay. The crazy thing is this. Strong people get into sinful situations that have 100% of crashing and burning, and they never give it a second thought. Isn't that crazy? People know they're going to crash and burn, and they do it anyway. And there's a 100% chance of crashing, and they still do it. They still get on the plane. You're like, wow. And they wonder why they did it to begin with. After it crashes and burns, and they're like, why did I do this to begin with? I knew this wasn't going to be good. But the problem is you can't go back on your decision. You've already made it. So before you make that decision, look to the future. Look to what it's going to do. Before the plane takes off, look to the future of what it's going to do. What is the cost of what you're about to do? And then last, and certainly not least, but look up. Look around, look within, look to the future, and then look up. This is what he essentially did in the last portion. In Genesis 39 and verse 9, the end of it, he says this: how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? It wasn't just about him, and it wasn't about Potiphar, and it wasn't about Potiphar's wife. Joseph knew that the wickedness he was about to do was actually a sin against God himself. If we just realize that all we need is God, we should be satisfied with just him. I think our, I forget what hymn it is, but he is our all in all. You remember that song? He is our all in all, Jesus. And goes on and on and on. Anyway, if you realize that God is all you need, and everything we do is against him, I think you'd make different decisions. And we do that. I don't know what else to say when we talk about making decisions, making discernment, making good judgments. What are judgments that you have made in life that have no eternal value? Give me those. Give me a decision you've made in life that have no eternal weight, no eternal value, have nothing to do with eternity. The kind of car you picked? The color of car you pick? Where you went to school? Like college or just any? Okay. So what'd you say, Pam? The clothes you wear? Now, why wouldn't those have weight in eternity?
God doesn't care where I went to school.
Doesn't he?
He's not keeping a record of that fact. He keeps a record of the fact that I am a child of his. He sees my name in the plans of his life.
Sure, Psalm 139 says he's got a schematic of every day of our lives. It's all mapped out of what we're going to do. Does he care what clothes we wear? I agree with Rob. God does not want you dressing up like a hooker. I'm just saying. So, yes, there are some aspects.
But he also don't want you to, like, flaunt your wealth and wear gold robes and stuff like that.
Exactly. And that's part of modest apparel. Actually, the Bible, when it talks about modest apparel, is just you shouldn't, it's twofold. Number one, you shouldn't wear anything to stand out, and you shouldn't wear clothing that makes you look like something that you're not. And that's where looking rich, you shouldn't wear stuff that makes you look richer than what you actually are. Most people that try to look rich aren't. And people that I know that are millionaires look like they're homeless people. You're like, look at this guy. This guy ain't got two pennies to rub together, and he's worth $38 million. Like, what?
Is it more of an attitude, though? I mean, there's nothing wrong with dressing well or looking good. It's just more conceit than more attitude.
It is. It's the idea of being deceiving when you're trying to deceive people.
Oh, like trying to put on the Ritz, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Or yeah, trying to, like, you're trying to dress like the opposite sex. You're deceiving people intentionally. There's nothing wrong with, you know, putting on certain stuff.
My wife won't let me buy a Cadillac. I wanted to buy one, but she wouldn't let me.
Is that your best decision? Is that you needed discernment in that? And she was your discernment.
I bought every other kind of car, but she wouldn't let me buy a Cadillac.
Why not a Cadillac?
I don't know.
That's funny. I'll have to ask her that one.
I actually did get one, but it was when I had the car lot.
Why would she let you get a Cadillac?
She didn't want to drive it, I guess.
So when you look around at what God has given you, and you look within, and then you look to the future, don't forget to look up, because God will always be there. God should be our satisfaction. In Genesis 15:1, after Abraham had won the battle between Sodom, Gomorrah, Zeboam, Admah, and Zoar, and he fought the battle for them, and they were going to give him all these riches. And he said, I don't want nothing from you, lest everybody say that you have made me rich. In Genesis 15:1, God says, you did good, Abraham, because I am your exceedingly great reward. God should be enough. And so it should be some type of contentment not to want another Cadillac or, well, you didn't have the first one to begin with, so that's not the issue. But not to be more than what you are. And that's what Joseph was. He was a servant, but he served God. And God always come first. And so I think we forget those aspects when we're trying to make decisions. That not only does this, look around. Do you have enough? And I think that's where greed comes in. People aren't content with what they have. And so they always want more. So are you blessed enough that you just, you know what, I don't need that. Or look within. Is this something that's just me? Look to the future. What's the future of that? I remember things that I purchased in my life. I wanted them for so long. And then I purchased them and never used them. I'd be like, what an ignorant moron. This is useless. And then you got to sell it for less than you bought it for. So you didn't. All you did was lose money on it. It's just dumb. You're like, man. So if I just looked to the future, I'd be like, wow, I'd be selling this for less, so I might as well not even buy it. That way I can save myself money. Yeah, go spend it on something else I'm not going to use and then spell cheaper than hairbrush, comb. Yeah, that was just saying. So if there's another guy's hair in that brush, I know it's not mine. I'm just saying. Well, yeah, I did have a beard straightener. That was cool, but that was kind of vain and useless, so I got rid of it. But Cody. That's what happens. That's what happens a lot. But the idea is that if you would just understand how important God should be to our lives. In Psalm 16, verse 5, the Living Bible says this way, the Lord himself is my inheritance. He is my prize. He is my food. He is my drink. And he is my highest joy. And he guards all that is mine. If God isn't enough, then you're going to look to other things. God has to be our satisfaction first. And so in our decisions, don't forget to put God as a factor. He should be the biggest factor in all of our decisions. Any questions? Because we always forget about the Lord. But he should be the first one that we think of.